I have often thought about what it takes to make a good leader. There are lots of people that study leadership, as there are many that I'm sure that would like to give you their opinion about what makes a good leader. I certainly can't compete with academics from Harvard or management consultants or Homer Simpson, who said, "Kids, you've tried your best and you failed miserably. The lesson is never try." What I think is the best lesson from all leaders is that leaders who have done the most to advance causes of the common good or human creativity or broad-based compassion or large-scale movements for equality are all people who've called us to our best selves. Now, that's a phrase that I've used before on many occasions, so let me just explore that, unpack that a little bit for you. On March 4th, 1861, as part of his inaugural address, President Abraham Lincoln said, "We are not enemies but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heartstone and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell with the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be by the better angels of our nature." By the better angels of our nature. What would be the better angels of our nature? Maybe if we were all living with ourselves, each other, and the planet with the better angels of our nature, we would all be vegan. Maybe we would live by the covenant of right relations. I mean, really know what it says and really practice it. I think if we all lived as our best selves, it wouldn't just be a beloved community, it would be some type of utopia. But alas, we are human. And so this type of utopia is something that may not ever happen in our lifetimes. Nevertheless, that is in part what I think leadership is. When we are called to or inspired by someone who is human, who has their own issues, but helps us feel that the path to living our best selves and calling forth the better angels of our nature can and does actually lie before us. Some of the greatest speeches ever given are littered with this kind of language. It's a part of what makes it a great speech. Last week, John Atchison quoted Frederick Douglass, a great speechmaker. He's a great speechmaker. I wasn't there personally, but I heard he was a great speechmaker. So on July 4th, 1852, arguing against the evils of slavery, Frederick Douglass said, "Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty? That he is the rightful owner of his own body? You have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? Is that a question for Republicans?" Not Republican Party as it is today. "Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty involving a doubtful application of the principle of justice to understand? How should I look today in the presence of Americans dividing and subdividing a discourse to show that men have a natural right to freedom? Speaking of it relatively and positively, negatively and affirmatively, to do so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven who does not know that slavery is wrong for him." In 1873, after Susan B. Anthony was arrested for trying to vote and was fined $100 for voting in the 1872 presidential election, she said, "It is we the people, not we the white male citizens." I love she said that in 1872. "Nor yet we the male citizens, but we the whole people who formed the Union. And we formed it not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them. Not to half of ourselves and half of our posterity, but to whole people, women as well as men. And it's downright mockery to talk to women of their enjoyment of the blessings of liberty while they are denied the use of the only means of securing them provided by this Democratic Republican government, the ballot. The subject also makes me think of the difference between politicians, what in male-centric language used to be called statesmen, the difference between politicians and statespeople, statespersons. One of the definitions I found was a political leader whose wisdom and integrity wins great respect. Do you know any statespeople now? I'm working on it. I haven't figured it out yet. I struggle at this moment in time to identify those folks in our government. And I think we all wish for this, someone who transcends petty politics and can lead us forward on some of the great issues of the day, someone who can be grounded enough in their own ego, comfortable enough in their own skin and steady enough in their own judgments, that they are conscious of a pretty good version of the common good and how to move us in that direction. The question arises, therefore, in the absence of that kind of leader, is it possible for that kind of leader to rise among us or be us? Many great leaders have helped to galvanize movements that have led to social and cultural change. The list we've used here all the time, we talk about this all the time. Martin Luther King Jr., Jane Addams, Mahatma Gandhi, Cesar Chavez, all the people who've helped move forward the causes of love and kindness and justice and connection. Last week, John said that in order to be in right relations, we're going to have to be in right relations in order to help save the planet. And I'd like to take that a step further. We're not going to be able to wait for leaders of change to help galvanize us. That means we may have to be in right relationship in ways that are far beyond what we already do, especially without a charismatic figure who's calling us to our best selves that usually helps lead the way. Environmentalist and businessman and author of the book Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming, said it this way. Paul Hawken. I now believe that there are over 1 million organizations working toward ecological sustainability and social justice, maybe 2 million. By conventional definition, this is not a movement. Movements have leaders and ideologies. You join movements. You study tracks. You identify yourself with a group. You read the biography of the founder or listen to them talk on and on in person. The movements have followers, but this movement doesn't work that way. It is dispersed. It's fiercely independent. There is no manifesto or doctrine, no authority to check with. He says, I sought a name for it, but there wasn't one. Historically, social movements have arisen primarily because of injustice or inequality or corruption. Those woes remain legion, but a new condition exists that has no precedent. The planet has a life-threatening disease that is marked by massive ecological degradation and rapid climate change. It crossed my mind that perhaps I was seeing something organic, if not biologic. Rather than a movement in the conventional sense, it is a collective response to a threat, he said. A collective response to a threat. It is splintered for reasons that are innate to its purpose. How does it function? How fast is it growing? How is it connected? Why is it largely ignored? Which I think is actually true. After spending years researching this phenomenon, including creating with my colleagues a global database of this organizations, I've come to this conclusion, he says. This is the largest social movement in all of history. No one knows its scope, and how it functions is more mysterious than what meets the eye. What does meet the eye, though, is compelling. Tens of millions of ordinary and not so ordinary people willing to confront despair and power and incalculable odds in order to restore some semblance of grace, justice, and beauty to this world. Willing to confront despair, driven to restore grace, justice, and beauty to this world. Isn't that sort of our mission here? Not word for word. but certainly part of the essence that lies at the core of what we are as Unitarian Universalists. Being in a progressive religious community like this is perhaps one way to replace that charismatic leader figure, to draw strength and purpose and sustenance from each other. We talk about right relationship, the interconnected web of all existence, and we collectively have grown weary at times of leaders in this country. And we also have tendency today to look more closely for flaws than for inspiration. We've become a little bit jaded with our leadership. We somehow have created a standard of behavior for leadership that struggles with the imperfection of being human. And still with all that being true, we can become complacent without that motivating voice, without those who can rise above the noise and speak to our hearts and speak to our hopes. This uncharacterizable movement of the people that Paul Hawken is describing is about us. It's about all of us looking deep within and finding the better angels of our nature and taking responsibility, personal responsibility, to join, to lead, to inspire, to act, all of it. We all have different gifts. We all have different things to offer. We all have different ways of doing things. But this commitment is about calling ourselves and each other to our best selves. As I've said now many, many times, this means we might not always be the ones in charge. We shouldn't always be the ones speaking first. We may have to cultivate long-term ideas and relationships, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, that push beyond our comfort zone. And there will be times when we need to step up when others feel lost, when others are struggling or need help moving through their comfort zones, where we will help provide the backbone and the strength to do that. Where is that better done than here? How can we think of this congregation as being a support system for each other on the road to a better world, where we are all here for each other as we travel through the issues like climate change, as well as other challenges that face our world today? This 30 Days of Love campaign this year that Tiffany talked about has a focus in the title, and that title is Commit to Respond. And yes, it is designed to be about the climate crisis, but I'd like to suggest that it's about that and more. We're at a stage of life on the planet where we can't always wait for someone else to start the movement, to galvanize action. We can't always wait for someone who is willing to be part of something that's bigger than us. We have to reach down deep and find the better angels of our nature in order to help the changes we wish to see be born into this world. Another pretty good speech maker, John Kennedy, he was president for you younger folks who are out there. He said it this way about going into space. Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory was to die on Mount Everest. And he was asked before that, why did he want to climb it? He said, because it's there. Well, space is there and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which humans have ever embarked. There is always opportunity in crisis. And great leaders of the past and the present and the future are telling us it is our turn. We can make a difference, and now is the time to go deep, support each other, be our best selves, and climb, climb, climb. May that be so.